everybody. I'm Andy Weinberg, and welcome to episode 43 of the David Wasikinen In The Pocket podcast. Coming to you live on phillyrockradio.com, and you can find this and all of our episodes at in-the-pocket.simplecast.com. Before we get started this week with a legendary guest, want to real quick mention our sponsors. Want to thank the great people at Behavioral Pediatrics and ABA Therapy Associates in Lansdale, Pennsylvania for their continued support. They're working with autistic children, teens, and young adults, doing great work. If this affects your family, please call them at 267-663-7141. Also want to thank our friends at Croker Percussion. They make all kinds of very cool percussion instruments. You can find them on the web at crokerpercussion.com. And of course, our friend, great friend of the show, Mark Maiolino, for his continued donation to the show to help keep us going. Well, Dave, today, August 15th, is the 50th anniversary of a little music festival. It took place in a town called Bethel, New York, at a place called Yasgur's Farm. Of course, I'm talking about Woodstock. And we are so fortunate to have on the line with us one of the incredible musicians who actually performed there that weekend. He's the drummer from one of the greatest bands of all time.
Truly.
Creedence Clearwater Revival. He still performs all their hits today in a band called Creedence Clearwater Revisited. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome on the line from California, the great Doug Cosmo Clifford.
Cosmo, how are you, Doug?
Good, boys. How are you doing?
Doing great, man. I was really excited about, we had a couple weeks off getting back with you to kick off our podcast again, and did today being the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. You know, it's a big deal. You know, like last weekend, I played a Woodstock festival with a band I play with called Smash Palace, and everybody was, you know, reminiscing about the old Woodstock, people that actually were at Woodstock or claimed to be at Woodstock. And what a special day that was. And to have you on our podcast today to be able to talk about that is really exciting, man. And I'm thrilled to have you here, man. Doug, thanks for getting up in the morning there in California to join us.
Well, it's my pleasure, and actually we're in Nevada.
Oh, okay. All right. That's still on the West Coast there. You're up, so you got the West Coast time there, though, right? It's 8 a.m. back there,
yeah.
Right? There you go.
West Coast time. I'm near Lake Tahoe. I'm in between Reno.
I was going to come out there in a couple weeks. That's a nice place out there, man. It's great.
It's beautiful out here.
Yeah, yeah.
But, Doug, we got so much we want to talk about with you, but since we started off with this actually being the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, let's start there. You know, you guys played what, like 1-2 in the morning and on Saturday night, Sunday morning. What's the first memory that jumps out at you when you think back to 50 years ago this weekend?
Well, there's so many, and I guess I'll try and do it chronologically. The day before, we were doing an Andy Williams television special. And Andy was having problems. They had two or three different unions, and they all had different break times, and they all hated each other.
So nice.
That was a pretty mellow environment.
Yeah.
The thing that saved it for me was Ray Charles was there, and the Ray Letts came in, and it was a reunion that was, you know, it took years to have happened for whatever reason. They all loved each other, but you know, they were doing different things. So to see that reunion and to listen to them, you know, singing around the piano, man, I had chills. And that was the good news.
Yeah.
The bad news was, while all these things were going on and our time slot was up, everything came unglued on the production end of it. None of it was ours.
Yeah.
It was all theirs. And
right.
Make a long story short, we kept canceling our flights and getting new flights to fly in.
Yeah.
But at that point, no, we didn't have a clue about what was happening out there.
Yeah.
And we were just trying to, you know, be good soldiers and get the treatment part of it done. Mm-hmm. And then it ended up where we said, look, we have the last, this is the last flight. It's a red eye.
Yeah.
We've been up all day and we're going to be up half the night and we've got this gig we've got to get to.
Yeah.
So you get it on the stake and or you don't.
Yeah.
And right in the middle of it, there was a big feedback. Who knows what it was. And John rolled his eyes, and that take was used, so you could probably dig that up somewhere on YouTube. But
wow.
Anyway, so now we're off to New York. You know, and
it's been a
very nerve-wracking day, but we're there on our way.
Yeah.
And so we land, and then we're supposed to get in a private jet and get in nice and close. And then go from, you know, ground transportation in.
Amazing.
Well, they said, well, we've got to change your plans here, boys. Well, we said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, you can't drive in. And, you know, we're going to have to change all the transportation.
Mm.
Why is that? Well, because there's 500,000 people there. And they just left their cars in the middle of the street because the streets were jammed up. And it was going, right. I was born at night, but not last night.
Yeah.
And that was the year of the pop festival. So we had done quite a few of those. And so we knew what 100,000 people looked like. We knew what 150,000 people looked like.
Wow.
You know, so we could judge the numbers that way. And we're still not buying in, you know, 500,000 people. You guys are out of your mind.
Right.
So anyway, we finally got to the point where we were flying in a 2-man helicopter, now a 3-man helicopter.
Wow.
Well, I was the guy on the flip of the coin that got the outside seat. So my right leg is out the door of this thing.
Oh,
so little bubble top.
Yeah.
My foot's on the skid. I'm holding the door because otherwise it's flapping and it's not good. And it's also flapping on my knee, which was really not good.
Right.
And so I'm holding on to the middle seat to stay in.
Yeah.
And the sun was starting to go down. And it was like a movie shot, you know, it was unbelievable.
Apocalypse Now, man. Yeah.
Yeah, beg pardon?
It's like Apocalypse Now, the movie, you know, when
it
came in.
Without the fire.
Right.
So anyway, as we came up over the rise, you know, colors were brighter than they were hours before because, you know, as the sun wanes, things get a little brighter. All of a sudden, as we came up over this rise, there was, and I said, it's a patchwork quilt of humanity. That's what it looked like. It looked like
amazing.
A huge quilt, all the colors blended together. And I was flying in with John, and we both had our jaws.
Wow.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
So, and this is how much of a fairy tale the thing is. As we were landing, there was a building off to the left. It was a 3-story building, and at the top floor, two ladies were leaning out the window, waving to everybody when the helicopter would come in. It was Joan Baez and Judy Collins.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Whoa.
Wow.
This is not happening.
Oh, man.
And you could feel the energy there.
You knew
and,
it.
As we landed. Yeah, we knew it. This is the real deal.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it's a logistical nightmare. Where is our gear and where is our crew?
We
had no idea where they were.
Right.
So, they'd come in earlier and we were wondering, how is there the equipment in here?
Yeah.
We were flying in this goofy little helicopter.
Right.
I don't know how they did it to this day. They just did it and got it. Ready to go.
It still blows my mind. It still blows my mind when I see how you guys pulled off that production and you see films now. And I remember being a kid and seeing the movie and not knowing, like, I didn't realize how many other bands played that weren't in the movie, the first movie. That's why I'm glad this record's coming out because, you know, I Mountain, who saw that they played later, you guys played, there are bands that were not in that film. And when I was a young kid, I thought, oh, that's all who played. But it was just so much bigger than I even realized. And it's so great that over the 50 years, and especially now, it's coming to light that what, you know, what occurred. And even when you look online, the beauty of the internet and the information, sometimes wrong, sometimes right, but looking about like what people were paid to play and stuff like, I found it fascinating.
Right.
You guys, and you tore it up. You played over an hour. Didn't you play over an hour when you played? Like, you played a lot of songs.
Well, we were a lot of an hour.
Yeah.
A lot of other bands overshot that mark.
Right.
By quite a bit, like double.
Yeah.
And that was one of the bands we had to follow. We were a little upset about that.
Yeah.
But we fought to be in the movie, and John said, "No, we don't. We're number one. We don't need it."
Wow.
And Well, it's a pretty amazing thing to be part of.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the legend grew, and each year they went by, it survived because it was such a unique, once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Indeed.
They had, that audience had no potable water, no shelter. Mm-hmm. Everything was wet and cold, and they made a decision collectively that okay, that's going on, but look at this lineup. We're going to get some good rock and roll here. So that was it. I mean, the hair on my arm stood up when I saw these people running in the mud, sliding naked down the hill.
Indeed, indeed.
I want to join.
Oh, and, man.
On that, but I only have one set of clothes and I'm wearing them.
Yeah.
Well, it's crazy too. It's crazy too, Doug. Yeah. That I mean, you guys came on. It literally was the middle of the night. I mean, it was you came on after the Grateful Dead, and you were supposed to come on even later because I think the Dead set got cut short because they had some technical issues or something like that. But you end up coming on at according to the internet, it was like 1 a.m.
Me too. Yeah.
And I guess I've read somewhere that at that point the crowd was a little mellow because the Dead had just played. And yeah. Did you kind of feel like you had to win over the crowd at that hour or what?
Well, we did. The stage was bare bones. I mean, there was hardly any, there were no working lights, like show business lights.
Wow.
And things like that.
Sure, Vocalmaster.
It was dark. I mean, you can see it if you go online. See our performance. You can actually see it. Unfortunately, this thing is coming out now, but there's no video. And I said, seeing is believing.
Wow.
Nobody knows that we were at Woodstock to this day. I mean, very, very few people.
Right.
And I will say this about that. I think if we had not accepted and gone and made the decision to go with these new guys, they had a concept.
Yeah.
But they had no experience
in
production or anything like that.
Yeah.
So we went with it, and all the big acts were sitting on the sidelines, waiting for a big act to take it. At that time, we were number one in the world in record sales and number one concert act. So when we said, "Well, we'll give it a shot," the instant we said yes, all the other ones jumped in. Had we said no, might not have been a Woodstock.
Would have been a different thing, right?
Yeah, I read that you guys were like the first act to sign on.
Yeah.
Yeah, major act.
Right.
I mean, there were some smaller acts, and that people wouldn't leave their homes and their cars, for that lineup. So, once we said yes, the big boys came in, and I've often thought, what the hell would have happened had we said no?
Yeah, the entire musical history would have changed. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, your band, I mean, Creedence, as a drummer, young drummer, 11 years old, I remember, I was inspired Stones, Beatles, that whole British thing. And then I remember as I got older, I remember getting Cosmos Factory and having that record, playing the album. And people don't know what a revolutionary drummer is. And still to this day, Mr. 18-inch hi-hats I'm talking to, you, are somebody that, like, is always taking it to the edge. You're the first drummer I ever saw using North drums. I remember that. I was like, what the fuck is this guy playing? I remember seeing that and just being blown away, because I don't know how long you played them, but you were the first guy I ever saw. And then I saw Kunkel playing them later, but I remember you playing them. And the fact that you play great, you always played great, and what a band that was. But, you know, to this day, you're still pushing the envelope. It's still doing stuff. And I love that about you, Doug, that you're still so deep into it. And as when we were talking before we went on air, when you're talking about the sound of your drums, that you still care the way you do and you're so passionate about it. I find that just so inspiring as a drummer, because I'm the same way, you know. It never leaves me. And you were talking about, like, well, it didn't sound like a snare drum, man. You know, it's really nice to see that. And you, or somebody that those grooves that you played, I happened to teach a group of kids with a friend of mine, and we were doing the Woodstock show, and we added Creedence Clearwater is in that show. They may not have known it in the movie, but you're in that show because you're such a vital part of the rock and roll legacy of rock and roll, man. And you have such a big part of that, Doug.
Well, I thanks for the kind words. You know, we were 13-year-olds and record collecting rock and roll in its kind of infancy, really.
Yeah.
Back in the 50s, late 50s.
Yeah.
And early 60s. And rock and roll was forbidden in the school band, so we were never in the school band.
Wow.
Because we wouldn't be able to play what we wanted to play. And it was kind of schmaltzy, and a real stand was made by faculty. We can't have this rock and roll stuff.
Yeah, you went through that.
Here, but,
wow.
We started the band when we were in the eighth grade, and
I love that.
I started with, as you say, you wonder about the passion. Well, the passion's always been there. I mean, it was. And this is what we were attempting to do. Someday we want our songs played on the radio.
Yeah.
But they're still playing them.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed they are. And you know, like you like the Beatles and Stones, you gave us a new style to listen to, because I know that you guys, what you were listening to, and then you morphed it into what you guys do, and you had John and Tom and yourself, like, doing music that was just, you know, you brought your thing to that. And I didn't realize, and obviously you had to be very, very young. You were 13 years old playing that as a band. That is so badass. I can't tell you how cool that is to hear, you know. And to this day, you're still out there playing.
I think it's safe to say that there's no band that has ever sounded like CCR.
No.
I mean,
a lot of people try to sound like CCR.
Right, but you created a sound that really was never really completely duplicated, I would say. I mean,
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to the roots, the beginning.
Yeah.
We were 13. Tom was 4 years older than we were. He was in a really good band called Spiderweb and the Insects.
Yeah.
They were prototypical musicians. They didn't understand an opportunity.
Yeah.
And they bailed on going into the studio and recording some demos, and Tom was going to take them to L.A. to try and get a record contract.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the story, and it's word for word. Tom came in and he said, I've got two songs I want us to learn. And once we got them, I booked studio time. We're going to go into the studio, cut them. I'm going to get in my car, drive to L.A. and try and get a deal. So the guys are kind of not thrilled with this. So we're getting paid. No, I'm paying for the session. I'm paying for my trip down to L.A.
Yeah.
This is all out of my pocket.
Right.
And I'm not asking you guys to chip in. I'm just,
wow.
This is what we want to do.
Wow.
Next question. Are there going to be any chicks there?
Yeah.
No. We're going to go and record. This is our future. And this is the final tapper.
Yeah.
No thanks. We'd rather work on our cars. Enter the Blue Velvets. Tom had seen us, you know, we were an instrumental trio, and Tom was very supportive of us as younger kids and his younger brother. And he was always very supportive, and he came to us and said, "This is what I want to do. Would you guys back me up?" And he said, "Make a record." And he said, "Yeah." And we said, "Of course we'd love to do it."
Wow.
And and that's how it started.
Wow.
And so we were learning to play our instruments together, and we were learning to record at the same time. There's your sound.
Yeah.
There's your sound.
That's a great story. Yeah. You know, and back in the day when you were using tape, and back, I mean, I don't know, what, two-track, four-track? Probably two-track, right? Back in those days, going way back.
Well, back when we went into the studio, it was mono. It was just, there was no, this was pre-stereo.
Wow.
And so they had two mics in the room, and it went to this, I guess it was quarter-inch tape.
Yeah.
But it was not stereo. The stereo hadn't been invented yet.
Uh-huh.
That's the level of technology that we were at, and then they take when it's done, then they play the tape into a little machine, which is nothing more than a lathe, and it would cut it into what they called acetate. So it had like aluminum in the center, and then they sprayed this plastic on it.
Yeah.
But what that means is that. Yeah, you can play it on a record player, but it's going to start losing fidelity after 10 plays.
Exactly.
And after 100 plays, it goes on and on and on. But, you know, I took it home and I was so proud of it. I've got a copy of that first session in my iTunes.
Wow.
And I play it for people that I think would get a kick out of it.
Oh, that's
but
wonderful.
That's how it started. It was, without Tom Fogarty, I wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah.
It was Tom who backrolled all of it, and he had a wife, two kids, a house with a mortgage, and a good job, and he threw it all in. And it took us 10 years to have our first hit record.
Wow.
Yeah, and then you didn't stop having hit records for like 4 years. I mean, the run that CCR had from 68 to 72, 73, I mean, in such a short period of time, the amount of incredible... I mean, you guys had three multi-platinum albums in the same year.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Who does that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible.
It was a different world, you know?
Well, I call this, the Roman candle of rock and roll. And then to add insult to injury... we put singles out in between albums just to keep the flow.
Keep
the
it going.
The theory was, if we're ever off the charts, we'll be forgotten. Well, that's ludicrous. You know, everybody else was off the charts.
Right.
But when the albums came out, they were the multi-platinum, the big acts.
Right.
So anyway, that was the deal. So when we would put a single out, now they're double-sided hits. So our burn rate is double. So in other words, we have two singles for the price of one.
Right.
And so that kept us, almost behind schedule because, we had all this time and we got two singles going at the same time.
But just an example
just put the pressure on.
Yeah, example of what Doug's talking about for people who don't know. Traveling Band and Who'll Stop the Rain was a double sided single. Can you imagine release as a single? You know, you release both those songs at once. Mm. I mean, these are two just
classic songs and lyrically just genius stuff. I mean, the music today, I mean, some bands I play with cover this stuff. I mean, we play. It's like, what do you want to play? Let's do this. You know, Fortunate Son or something. I mean, just unbelievable, man. And you always had this. There was this. The lyrics were great. They were socially conscious. You know, it was like just great stuff, man. And obviously, John was pretty driven. You know, obviously, doesn't want to get off the charts. We've got to keep working, doing it. But I sense that all you guys were, pretty motivated to keep on working and playing because you're still because you're still at it and doing it the way you're doing it. It's impressive.
Well, what we would do is we would, in between albums, we would jam. And out of those jams, there were songs that came out. We never got any credit for that, but I know what we brought to the table.
Yeah, I know. And, been there.
You know, in a less than 4 year period, we had 10 top 10 singles.
Right.
And in actuality, it ended up being 17 because of the double sided hits.
Yeah.
And right. then John, as a solo artist, in 4 years, has had 2 top 10 singles. So,
yeah. God bless him.
We brought a lot. We were always serious, always straight and sober. That was a very strict rule.
Yeah.
And we said, the music, if the music doesn't get us high, we should be doing something else. So,
good for
we
you.
Had a work ethic, second to none.
Yeah.
And it paid off. And then I had little Sony tape recorders. And I would put it on the floor of the factory's rehearsal space.
Yeah.
And I set it so I could hear all the instruments. Then I would take that home and put it onto 4-track and then work on the homework, literally homework, stuff that needed to be done. That's how you keep the pace up.
That's awesome. That's so awesome.
I did, you know.
Yeah, I love it.
Two hours after playing for 4 hours in the studio and working stuff out, and so that way you could, you know, see if some a part's going to work or not going to work.
Right.
I had to come up with the parts and.
You have drummers now that like play with John that try to cover your, you know, like, do you ever listen to what so-and-so, what is he doing with my part, or, you know, because really as a drummer, you have a certain feel, because I know one thing about Creedence, like that stuff's not, oh yeah, that's easy. It's not easy. I mean, because what's really cool about it is the whole way it had a swing and a feel to it. And, you know, you guys really thought about that stuff and worked at it. You know, I mean, that's something that I know from drummers that I've known that played those songs that would tell me that, like, you know, that's I had to work at that. Like Aronoff has told me, I've had to work at that stuff to play like you played.
Well, you know, when I watch those guys play, they don't play like I play. They don't play the fills are. Every fill that I play on those records was thought out.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I have to fight for things. An example, our first single was Susie Q.
Yeah.
And that was a rockabilly song, an 8-note right hand on the hi-hat song. And in the clubs, we were doing 6 nights a week, 5 sets a night. Well, you know, your material gets stretched pretty thin.
Yeah.
So what we did is I came in with this quarter note beat.
Right.
Quarter note on the ride cymbal.
Yeah.
So it takes it all of a sudden now.
Yeah.
There's this bass. And then in between, the eight notes in between are bass drum hits. So
all right.
Bass,
yes.
Boom.
Yeah.
And then by having quarter notes, having the quarter notes play, it opened up that song for the guitars. It gave them all the room to swing with that groove.
Yeah.
And it's simple, but it's well thought out, engineered that way.
Yeah.
And it became one of our popular songs at these gigs because the people could dance to it.
Right.
And we said, okay, we need to kill time, so we're going to make it a 10-minute song.
That's cute. Yeah.
And a perfect example, if you want to hear that beat, play Susie Q, because it comes in with the drums.
Yeah.
The drums fade in.
It's genius, man.
And
that's great.
Comes in, and then in the end, the drums fade out.
Yeah.
So you can hear what I'm talking about with that quarter note. It just opens up and sets the guitars up to kill.
Yeah.
And those are a lot of drummers don't think about stuff thinking about.
It's great stuff.
Kicking time and doing, you know, not being musical. In other words, we were an instrumental trio and we played top 40 hits. So every song we're playing is a hit record.
Right.
And all those little gems are in there. And that's how I taught myself how to play, listening to AM radio and then the records that I bought.
Very much like Ringo with the Beatles. I mean, really, in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, those, you listen to, you know, the Beatle records and how those parts were thought out. Creedence was very much like that too. You know, like you approached it like those guys approached it. You know, like I'm thinking about how.
Well, being mentioned in the company of Ringo, thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well,
I love Ringo.
Yeah.
I really just met. You know, was overshadowed by the John and Paul and
yeah.
George became a great writer and
yeah.
So in a lot of ways, I think Ringo was didn't ever get the credit that
musical was man.
I've had conversations with guys who said, "Oh, Ringo, you know, didn't do anything." Like, I mean,
oh, please.
He was in the greatest band of all time.
Yes.
And
there's a reason he was, too.
And brought a very simple style and concept to wonderful songs. So,
exactly.
Don't tell me that, you know.
Yeah,
Ringo,
I know. I don't even. I didn't get in a conversation with somebody when, like, somebody said. Somebody said, "Well, do you think Ringo was a good drummer?" I said, "I can't even believe you'd ask me that." I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, he was a musical yeah. genius, as you are too. Same thing. You came up with great parts.
Well,
you talk
about
Susie.
No,
Doug. Honestly, you listen to Susie Q. Those records, "Fortunate Son." That stuff you played was just. You know, you were the man on that stuff, you know, and to this day, still playing it. You know, do we have anything?
Well, they just put out, and we were talking about how a lot of people didn't even realize CCR was at Woodstock. Yeah. They just rectified a huge, you know, that huge problem. They put out an album, CCR Live at Woodstock, which has the full 11-song set.
Yeah.
We have a couple songs that you guys performed 50 years ago this weekend. And Doug, you were mentioning before the show, you'd like us to play I Put a Spell on You?
Yeah,
and
it's not one of our, you know, it's not one of our greater, better known hits, but it's all it was one of my favorite songs that we played at Woodstock. Where it was very powerful, and why not? Everybody
right.
expects Proud Mary and Fortunate Son. Here's a little something different.
All right, Taylor, let's hear I Put a Spell on You from CCR Live at Woodstock.
Thank you.
I'm just trying to imagine the scene as you guys are just absolutely killing that.
Yeah, no monitors either.
Stage, and then just a sea of people in the dark, in the mud, in the cold. Right. When you hear that, Doug, does you know what flashes through your head?
Well, just the whole night. And, you know, we couldn't see the audience because there were barely any lights on the stage, and that was it. You know, there were no lights, audience lights. So you could sure hear them and feel it.
Yeah.
We woke them up, no doubt about it.
Wow.
But it would have been pretty cool just to be able to see them, see what they were doing, and. But it was part of the mystique, you know. They were out there in mass, but we couldn't see them. Mm. And but the energy, you just grabbed it like a sponge, you know. Here we are, and we knew, having seen it, that it was real, and the massive audience was right before us. We couldn't see him.
Yeah, that's it. I read something John was saying in an interview with him. And actually, no, he was on CBS, the Sunday News last week with the anniversary coming up. And he was talking about, they interviewed him and Graham Nash, who both had. What I was wondering is, when you played, did you get to see any other artists? Did you get to hang with any artists when you were there? And how long, when you played, did you leave immediately? And how long, were you there?
Well, we got in, as I said, and got the news about what was going on, and there were delays because of weather, and also technical delays because of weather.
Exactly.
Rain and electronics, not a good combo.
Not a good combo.
And our deal was, you know, we weren't there to hang out. We were there to
play,
to do our business.
Right.
And we were doing everything we could to try and get our gear. Once we got that going, we got a crew to set it up, and we weren't sure when we were going on or what was going to happen, if we could go on at all, because we had a gig the next night. We had never missed a gig ever in our career to that point, and we weren't going to make a party of it. We were there to work.
Right.
And once we got, if we got a set in, was kind of where it was hanging.
Yeah.
When we were done, we had to get the hell out of there.
Okay.
As hard as it was getting in, getting out was going to be equally as hard to do.
Right.
And so it was pretty much all business for us.
Helicopters again on the way out then, right?
Well, I don't remember that one. What I do remember was there was a farm boy there who had snow tires on the back of his, of his car. Everything was rear-wheel drive then. And we had a $100 bill, and we told him, and that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
In those days, especially to a kid who worked on a farm.
Right.
We told him if he could get us out, we'd give him the $100 bill. If he couldn't get us out, we wouldn't give him anything. And, so anything we can do, you know, inspire this guy to get us the hell out. And he basically was able to do that. Now we put the pieces together and started our exodus. And we made our gig the next night playing with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band in New Jersey.
Right. Wow. I mean, what an experience. It's just unbelievable.
There was another festival a couple weeks before Woodstock that took place just near where we do this studio, where we do our podcast at Wildfire Studio here in West Deptford, New Jersey, Atlantic City Pop Festival, which was the first week in August of 69. Do you have any memories of that, Doug?
Yeah, that was a great one.
Yeah.
One of the better ones.
What a lineup.
As I said that. Oh, yeah. That was the year of the Pop Festival.
Yeah.
Again, we had a really nice set, and we did a well-run affair for sure. What I remember, this may be odd, but I remember seeing a platform that went pretty high up in the air, and then there was a pool at the bottom of it, and this horse would jump off.
Yes, Yes.
The platform into the water.
Yes.
That's what I remember.
Yes, yeah.
Silly stuff, but I went, holy crap.
Yeah, that was a big big thing there at the and a steel pier, by the way.
I actually just went there.
Yeah, well, the horse would march up the stairs and he would jump off, and then I think at some point they, you know, obviously they stopped doing that, but I remember as a kid going to see there. Steel Pier was the place that I saw the animals there, Herman's Hermits, Gladys Knight and the Pips. You know, I saw all the bands play, and I remember that when the Atlantic City Pop Festival went on, the Spivaks and Larry Maggot, that was a show that, you know, those guys they did, and the Iron Butterfly played, Procol Harum, Booker T and the MGs, Joni Mitchell, Chicago, Santana, Johnny Winter, Creedence Clearwater, Tim Buckley, the Byrds, I mean, Hugh Masekela, a band that, you know, a Philly band here that was like a legendary Philly band called the American Dream played, and Janis Joplin, Canned Heat. I mean, it was an amazing lineup. And, you know, Woodstock came, had the film, and it was just so viral, and it just it outshadowed that day of the Atlantic City Pop Festival. But it was a massive event, and it was well attended, and you had great weather there. Right. It didn't rain that right. weekend.
Yeah, that was a good one all the way around.
Yeah.
It just went off like, you know, clockwork. Boom,
yeah.
boom, boom. Everything
yeah.
The way it should be done.
Yeah.
Hey, as long as we're talking 1969 memories, a couple other big things that happened for you guys that year was two appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the pinnacle for a, you know, up and coming music act to be on Sullivan. What do you remember about your time on Ed Sullivan?
Oh boy. the first time. You know how he had all those strange moves and mannerisms and slurred language and et cetera. I mean, he was like an uncoordinated guy. But, you know, to Ed's credit, he did a lot for rock and roll. He brought, that's where I saw Elvis Presley when I was 11 years old.
Yeah.
And he was blocked out from the waist down. Is
right.
he naked? What's he doing
yeah, exactly.
back there?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
did more for Elvis's career than you could possibly imagine. But for us, we went back there, and it was just the four of us. We didn't have a manager. The last rock and roll band that came through there was the Rolling Stones, and they were apparently assholes. They got drunk. They threw all the beer cans in the toilet. Then they shit on top of the beer cans.
Oh no!
And they were bad boys.
The Stones.
They gave them trouble the whole time. So we were met by this little guy at 9 in the morning named Eddie, and he had bulging eyes. I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
With these big veins, and it looked like a monster.
Yeah.
And he said, you know,
don't you fuck with us.
90 minutes worth of talent.
Yeah.
And for a 1-hour show, so we can pull the plug on you up to showtime. If you're yeah. gonna, you know, which, no, look, we're not like that.
Yeah.
We came here to work.
Yeah.
You know, we care about what we're doing, and anything that we can do, let's work together and
yeah.
you know, get the job done.
Yeah.
And so, and of course, after that was our work ethic. Well, they had this little setup. It was like supposed to be a swamp thing. You know, it was very corny
yeah.
set for us. And so they said, if Ed likes you during dress rehearsal, that's good. He'll call you over, and that means, you know,
yeah.
you're going to be asked some questions, and
right.
it's going to be a pretty cool thing. So he calls us over. Of course, he liked it.
Yeah.
And we were in the headline spot.
Yeah,
just before Topo Gigio. You know,
right, Topo Gigio.
Mom's
oh,
Mabley. I love that little.
And Mom's Mabley used to do that.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Mom, yeah,
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 right.
Mom's Mabley.
Yeah,
that's
man, I watched it every week.
Gotta love her.
I watched it every
gotta
week.
Love her too.
Every
anyway,
week.
Anyway, they, you know. They said, okay, here's how you do it. You come over and ask each one of us our name, and there's a cue card guy there, and he's writing down these questions for all of us. And he said, when you come off, you know, I'm going to ask you guys these questions. So you have to be in order of the cards. And we said,
right.
okay, that's cool. So Ed goes off to lunch to start drinking. That's why Ed was goofy, because he was absolutely shit-faced come showtime.
Wow.
So now, you know, this is the deal. I mean, 30 million people. It's live, baby. My grandma's watching, you know. I can't screw up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they made us stay after the dress rehearsal. And so we were in position. Yeah. And they'd say, song's over. So we'd all walk over, and they had a guy standing in.
Yeah.
And we did it for an hour.
Wow.
And we were hungry.
Yeah.
And nobody else was doing anything. They were, you know, kind of punishing us, I guess, for the stones.
Right.
So we had it down, and, you know, the show comes, and it's pretty exciting, you know.
Yeah.
And we finish the song. We're all in perfect order. We walk over. Well, Ed is lit now. He's gone.
Right.
And he's excited, so he reaches over I forget who was in front of me, and then comes up behind with his left hand with somebody else. We're out of order. He's pulled us out of order.
And he's asking, right.
So he said, so John, what are you doing? No, I'm not John. I'm Doug. Oh, okay, well, you know, I'm John. Oh, well, it says that you're Tom. No.
And this is a live audience, too,
anyway,
right? You have a live audience.
Now, you know, here it is. A live audience. I mean, yeah. This is the big time. This is the big time.
Yeah.
And Ed is completely powdered.
Man. Well, you know, that's amazing.
They put us on the fifth floor of the theater because that was the highest dressing room, a lot of stairs.
Right.
They didn't have an elevator in there.
Right.
So they did everything they could to test our nerves. We didn't pay any attention to it. We were there for business. And our function was to play.
Great performance. Great.
I just watched it. Could have had a sign of order.
Yeah. I just watched it. It's great. I mean, with those little, they built that. It's amazing. I know that theater. I actually played that later on. I think that's where Letterman was doing his show because, you know, I did the Letterman show. And I remember it was Ed Sullivan Theater. And I remember going down there thinking, I didn't know what I was walking into. And it was a lot smaller than I thought it would be. And I remember being really cold in there. But I remember it was so much smaller. And I'm thinking about the Beatles and Creedence and the Stones and everybody. I never knew that story about the Stones. So now I'll think about that all the time. But, you know, what a history. Amazing history, man. Amazing history. That
you paid a price for their, you know, cavorting.
Yeah, yeah.
We ran up the stairs. It was all we could do to keep from just laughing at him, you know.
Yeah.
And all that mess and all the hour of, you know, boom, boom, practicing. What happened? Ed pulls us out of order because his breath was just, he's drunk.
Yeah. They're different.
Ed drinks.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting about Ed, you know, B was like a music critic and ended up becoming like, you know, one of the most important people in music because of, you know, the Ed Sullivan show and, you know,
exposing all these legendary acts to, you know, to middle America that otherwise might not have discovered, you know, bands like CCR.
Right.
You know,
amazing. And amazing.
So, another good friend of ours and a friend of to many, many artists, and particularly black artists, was Dick Clark.
Yeah. Yeah.
Philadelphia.
He started his show here in Philly.
Yep.
He started his show in Philly.
Philadelphia, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Your backyard.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's a rich heritage of music here, and Creedence were and still embraced by Philadelphia because we know great music, and you guys always were just laying it down, and, you always did well when you played here.
Hey, Doug, I want to...
We loved it.
Yeah, I want to get into Creedence Clearwater Revisited, the band you've had with Stu Cook since 1995, I guess, already. Wow. But I guess, you know, leading up to that, you know, the fact that CCR, the original CCR, you know, kind of ended after only 5 years. I mean, I guess maintaining that pace of hits and albums, I mean, that would have been impossible to keep going. Like I said, the streak that you guys were on for that period of time, I mean, eventually it was going to simmer down. But were you kind of bummed that it ended as quickly as it did?
Well, yeah, there was a lot of problems with the brothers. And then problems, John was the manager.
Right.
Just about being business manager, and he had zero experience, didn't even understand the contracts we had.
Right.
And then went in without lawyers and blamed Saul Zentz for, ripping him off. Beatles didn't own their songs either. It wasn't like a personal attack. Mm-hmm. But that's how he deals with business affairs, attacks.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. Steve's got a business degree, and I have this degree, and I'm not qualified. We're in the big leagues.
Right.
We need help. We need a mentor to settle a difference between you and Tom. We need a business guy to go in and get the business done.
Yeah. You
know, we were the number one band in the world in record sales for 2 years in a row, and ended up with the same contract that my parents co-signed because we weren't old enough. We went in with the worst contract you could have, the lowest one that they put out for nobodies, and here we are. Mm. And we go well beyond what we had hoped for.
Yeah.
And to come out, with nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been at odds for years, and blames us, and we know what happened, and wouldn't let his brother sing a song. And one of the things like about this Woodstock record is that there's a real strong presence with the rhythm guitar. You can hear what Tom Fogerty. That's all he was allowed to do. No, you can't send any songs. Don't send any material into me. Just play rhythm guitar and shut up.
Yeah.
And that was wrong. It was Tom that put us in a position to be there.
Right.
So anyway, Stu and I always took Tom's side, so we were in the doghouse all the time. And, it ended. But the good news is the legacy of music is like 10 years worth. So, we were busy, and it's a good thing we were, because we weren't going to be around very long.
Yeah, it's intact, that's for sure. It's the unfortunate reality of bands. It's hard to keep a band together. It's really difficult to do that for keeping it together. And then, you learn about business. We go in, we play music. We don't go into it with business degrees. It's like, you learn sometimes through your failures, the unfortunate reality with Creedence is that you became so massive, and then there's people out there that took advantage of that. And that happened a lot with the soul artists, the blues artists, and there's countless stories of bands that that people just assume these guys were millionaires because of publishing and that, and they got nothing. I know friends that have done that, and it's the sad reality of that business.
There's no business like show business.
Exactly. Oh, there's nowhere else we'd rather be, though, right? All right.
Yeah, it's, passing the baton. My mentor was Al Jackson Jr.
Yeah.
One of the best ever. And people, most people don't realize that Booker T and the MGs is not the band that did Green Onions. I mean, they did Green Onions, but that's they're like a one hit wonder. Well, people don't realize they're the house band. They're on every Otis record.
Al Jackson,
Sam,
man.
And Dave record.
Yeah,
all those hits. Mm-hmm. All those great hits.
Yeah,
Donald Duck Dunn was one of my dear friends.
Yeah,
I did some projects, some albums with Ducky.
Oh, and, I love your solo record, by the way, Doug. I love your solo record. She's about a mover, man's on that record, and you did that Latin thing, and I was listening to it, and I was like, man, you were listening to some great music. Was that 72? When that record? What was that?
72.
Yeah, yeah. 72. And I mean, you were
later
really
down the road.
Great.
Later down the road, I would do three albums with Doug Somm. I produced two of them.
Yes.
And then played on one Scandinavian record that we had a number one hit.
I bet.
So I did a little touring with that and a little touring with Lerch Song was the most talented guy.
Great.
But he was the,
yeah, I know.
Yeah, he was a nut, an energy nut. And to control him and to have him stay focused on one thing for very long
wasn't his thing.
Was unbelievable. But I could do it because he respected me.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, I'm here for you and to get your talent out and make the best record you possibly can.
Right.
And so that means you have to show up.
Showing up's a big part of it.
You have to focus. You can't be just sitting around smoking weed during the session. You've got to be productive.
Right.
You've got so much time, or so little time, actually.
Yeah.
And I want you to have your best performance. And that's how I dealt with Doug, you know. And he thanked me for it. And you know, he said we need to do another album. And then he passed away before.
Yeah.
Where we were able to do that.
Yeah.
He was, man, what a talent that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Just amazing.
Hey,
John Fogerty's no slouch.
Right. We only have a few minutes left, Doug, but I do want to give you the chance to talk about Creedence Clearwater Revisited, which, like I was saying before,
sure.
You and Stu started, I guess, a couple years after the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. You started
right.
In 95, and I guess all these years later, people still love to come out and hear the CCR hits, and you got a really great band that you play with. Are you surprised that you've been able to keep this going now for, 25 years almost? I mean, it's...
Yeah, I am surprised. We had a 5-year plan. We hoped we could squeak 5 years out. We hoped we would be accepted without John being in the band, and that's why it's called Revisited. We had the rights to call it a revival, but out of respect for our fans,
wow,
first and foremost, and
amazing,
and out of respect for John, we did it. John wasn't singing the songs at the time; he refused to sing them.
Yeah.
People wanted to hear it, and we said, "Well, we told him what we were going to do, and said if you want to do it, that's fine, and if you don't, that's fine." But
was there any pushback from John for this?
And then he sued us. Beg pardon?
Was there any pushback from John on that you guys were going to do that? Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, he sued us.
Oh, I didn't know. I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's unfortunate.
One of the many lawsuits that he's put up against.
I'm sorry.
Us, but we prevailed, and we have a great band, and we cared about this music.
You do.
Hugely. We treat it with respect, and it's all for the fans. You know?
Yeah.
People and it's, wanted to hear the band live.
And it's authentic because the rhythm section was such a huge part of the CCR sound
Stu's
we were talking about, you and Stu.
Oh, yeah.
Stu's
so
great.
To have, half of CCR or two-thirds of CCR, if you talk about the lineup without Tom,
yeah.
I mean, it's the CCR sound with obviously a different guitar player, different singer, but it's still very authentic. Mm. And people go to a CC Revisited show, they're going to know every song. I mean, it's
great songs.
Yeah.
And it's all about the content. I mean, it really is songs have so much to do with it, but if you got the two guys that were a part of that in the early days, and obviously can't have Tom, but it's like, you're bringing an authentic thing to it, and you have every right to, because you were there from day one doing that. So I'm glad to hear that you're still keeping on with that. It's amazing. It's really cool.
Well, there's good news and there's bad news. This is our last tour.
Why so?
We're packing it in. It's 25 years, far beyond whatever we had hoped. We never expected to have a platinum record out of it. We never expected to have a record out of it.
Right.
So we've done all the things. We're 74 years old.
Yeah.
The travel is tearing me up. Drumming is not good for the back, as you know. David.
I do. I do. The hips. I get it. I've had a hip replacement. I know, Doug. I know.
And I've got a bad back, and I've got grandchildren.
Yeah,
I've got my wife of 51 years that has let me come out and do my thing, and it's time to plus the family, and I also have another album that's ready to come out. I'm going to be working my publishing company, so I'll be in music, but more on the creative side than on the performance side.
Awesome.
Well, that means that is disappointing for those who haven't gotten the chance to see them. So that means if you have to go see Creedence Clearwater Revisited this year while you still have a chance.
Where?
They're going to be at, well, they played Ben Salem a couple months ago, the Excite Center, so you're too late for that. But they're going to be in Brookville, New York on Long Island on September 13th and Frederick, Maryland on September 14th. Go to Creedence-Revisited.com. That's their website. You can see other shows they're playing. You can get all the concert information. But if you haven't seen them and you love these songs, and let's face it, who doesn't?
Yeah.
Go see Creedence Creedence Clearwater Revisited while you still can,
and see Susie Q played right way.
Yeah, right.
Right.
With Doug Clifford and Stu Cook, the guys that were there from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know. So well, this hour flew by, Doug. This was
a real pleasure too, man. Hey, one quick question. What? I got to ask you as a drummer. You play those 18-inch hi-hats, and I wasn't kidding for your listeners. You play 18-inch hi-hats, but you played those North drums. Now you might have been remember those the ones that if somebody wants to look up North drums, take a look at them. How long did you play those? Yeah. How long were you playing them?
Not very long, and I never played them with Creedence.
Oh, moving them was a pain in the ass.
yeah.
Where do you get cases for them? Where do you get cases?
Yeah, well, I had them. I had them made, you know.
Jesus.
I mean, they're very fragile.
Yeah.
I did it for a while and then realized that, you know, this isn't going to catch on.
No.
And
I saw Kunkel using them once, and I was like, whoa, what are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there are a few guys that tried them out. I mean, they had a unique sound.
And, yes.
You know, just something to try out,
right,
if you will. But I was a Camco guy, and then DW bought Camco out, I'm a DW guy now.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
You know, they're the best, and, you know, John Good's been still there.
Great guy.
Started it.
Exactly.
Great guy.
Yeah, love John. And Garrison. Garrison, too. Good guy. Two really good people.
Hey, Garrison.
Yeah.
What a
sweetheart.
Team,
sweetheart.
Guys. And talk about caring. Those guys really care about
what they do.
And, you know, you really have to, you know. We made a decision on what we wanted to play early on, and we stuck with it, you know. And we came out of the San Francisco Bay Area during the psychedelic period, and our peers laughed at us and called us the Boy Scouts of rock and roll, so we'd never make it playing that kind of music.
You kicked ass. You proved them wrong, Doug.
Well, 50 some years later, turn on any FM radio in the country and you'll hear, you know, any rock station, you'll still hear CCR. So, yeah, I think things turned out okay for you guys.
Yeah, you know, what do you want to do? We want to have our songs played on the radio. Okay. We'll see about that.
Yeah. I hear you.
Well, let's play a CCR song on the radio right now to wrap it up with Doug. CCR Live at Woodstock just came out. How about a little Green River? That sound good to you, Doug, to wrap things up here?
I'm ready to take a swim in Green River.
All right. Here's a little Green River live at Woodstock, and then Dave and I will be back to wrap things up.
There you go.
That's a rock and roll band, cooking, folks. Man. That's a rock and roll band. Hey, Doug, you still there? Did we lose Doug? All right, I guess. Okay, well, I wasn't sure. We kind of said goodbye to him before.
Oh,
but
good.
I didn't know if he hung on or not.
I'm going to send him a note. Yeah. Thank him, but he was great.
He was great. I mean, talk about a guy that had been involved in some of the greatest songs in the history
of
rock and roll.
I mean, and relevant to this day, which is amazing to me.
Well, I mean, lyrically, they hold up.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Fortunate Son. I mean, it's.
Oh, man.
And, but yeah, musically, I mean, CCR is one of those bands that nobody dislikes.
Right.
Yeah, there's some bands that are very very divisive. You know, people either hate them or love them.
Right.
CCR is one of those bands you can't dislike them. I mean, they're just and that's they dominated classic rock radio in the charts, but their songs don't get old. You don't get
really
sick of them.
Great band. Great, but, and it's great to hear stories about how they started, what they do, and it's a bummer to hear how it ended up. But great that they kept playing. But relationship wise, that's kind of a sad situation, you know. So is he back? I heard something.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right.
Well, let's hear. Taylor. Let's hear a quick word from our sponsors at Behavioral Pediatrics and ABA Therapy Associates, and then Dave and I'll be back just for a few minutes.
There we go.
Hi, my name is Gabe, and I have autism. When I was diagnosed with autism, I realized it was hard for me to do what people call normal. For example, I would get easily upset and overreact to small problems. When it was time for me to go to college, I had an especially hard time. That's when I went to Behavioral Pediatrics and ABA Therapy Associates.
Gabe made the right choice.
They helped me prepare for college with my interests in mind. They taught me coping strategies, organization skills, and self-advocacy. Not only that, they boosted my confidence using evidence-based treatment programs such as Think Confident, Be Confident. This helped me prepare for employment opportunities as a peer mentor here at Behavioral Pediatrics and ABA Therapy Associates.
We are dedicated to improving the lives of teens and young adults with autism.
Thanks to them, I'm better prepared for college and can continue my life's journey. Now I can pursue a career in animation and continue my job as a peer mentor. Behavioral Pediatrics and ABA Therapy Associates in Lansdale, PA. Call us at 267-663-7141.
All right, we're back. Is Doug on the line?
Yeah.
Oh, we lost you. Good. We didn't know, goodbye.
Yeah, we wanted to say goodbye and thank you properly. We lost you during Green River or not, but
And
thanks so much for staying on with it. Your stories are incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
and your playing is great, and the fans are going to be sad to know that you're not going to be going on the road anymore, but you left a legacy of incredible music, incredible drumming, a great history. And so as a fan, fellow drummer, I thank you for what you did and what you do today. So thank you.
Well, labor of love, and thanks for having me on.
It was a pleasure.
I appreciate it, and thanks for the kind words. They are appreciated, and keep it going.
Yeah, we will, man.
All right.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks again, Doug.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, guys.
Thank you.
All right.
Great guy.
Dave,
called
so
back.
What were you in 1969 during Woodstock? What were you, about 13 years old?
69 would have been. I would have 72 when I was. I remember I saw Woodstock down in LA. I saw Woodstock, the movie, in Wildwood.
Okay.
I was down there. So I don't know.
But what year were you born, dude?
56. No, I don't mind.
Yeah, so
no,
you were 13
yeah,
years old.
13
yeah.
years old,
okay,
I remember.
So
and I was down the
so
shore.
You, there was no way you could actually go to Woodstock.
Well,
at 13
I had
years
friends
old.
That went to Woodstock. You know, that wasn't that uncommon for a 13-year-old to try to hitch a ride to Woodstock. Not me, though. I didn't go. My buddies, I remember Kevin and Al, they went to Watkins Glen, which my mom was like, you're not going anywhere. I was getting too much trouble back then. Who knows what would have happened. But Woodstock was something that I saw on film, and I remember seeing 10 years after. And Sly and the Family Stone, and Give Me an F, you know, that whole thing, Country Joe and Fish. It changed my life, you know, really did. It was like, oh my God, look at that, you know. And then later on, finding out all the different things, you know. I was already into Hendrix, you know, loved Jimi Hendrix. So, you know, it was this big, great, great
time. Yeah, well, even that's a whole other story. The Hendrix finished the festival on a Monday morning. It's like, you know, he's playing like
he was
7,
already done, and
7
he made,
o'clock Monday
He made
morning.
$18,000 though for that gig.
Yeah. What a weekend it must have been for those of you out there who were there. I'm sure, you know, this week's show brought back some memories.
John Lilly's partner, Bob, husband, went to went to Woodstock, but somehow didn't get, we went and he got stuck outside. Like he was spent like 3 days, like in a park or something, never got there. Some story.
Well, I imagine just getting there. I mean, obviously people did because there were 500,000 people there, but you see the pictures and you see the people on the roads. And it's like, just, you know, and then you hear the story about CCR coming in on this helicopter with Doug's leg hanging out the door. It's like, Jesus.
I had a friend of mine that was the, official photographer for Woodstock, and then I heard stories, and then an ex-girlfriend that went there and was hanging out with Nicky Hopkins, and you know, just an amazing stuff. You know, I got to know Grace Slick a little bit through her husband Skip, and you know, I remember once talking about Woodstock, and you know, you ask people what it's like and they go like, I don't remember. Or they remember little bits of it.
Just don't take the brown acid.
I know, there's the bad acid going, but what a day, you know. And it's fun reliving it, you know. It was fun. Like, I could only imagine. I was fortunate enough to play some pretty huge festivals, Live Aid and stuff. This weekend, we did some smaller concert live stuff outside, and it was fun. You know, we did a little thing that was like honoring Woodstock on Saturday. Did you see the news? There was a little news clip on ABC that was really nice.
Yeah.
And then, of course, In the Pocket played outside.
Well, In the Pocket played outside in Upper Marion, and it was an incredible show. Great performances by everybody. Yeah. And you look out up the hill on the grass, and, you know, it's a nice sized crowd.
It was awesome.
So, you know, whatever, a couple thousand people, whatever. So imagine looking out and seeing 500,000 people.
I mean, it was I couldn't imagine. And I've actually seen a little bit, like, but Woodstock was just so unique, and because just sound and just kind of that was the beginning of those big festivals, you know. So it you know, for a musician to be a part of anything like that is cool, you know. So
right.
I got to mention the art. We just put tickets on sale for
sure.
We're playing the Ardmore Music Hall on October 5th. And we have a new song with In the Pocket, and with Alexis Cunningham singing it. And we'll be featuring that. And the tickets just went on sale. Actually, you can get tickets, I think, tomorrow.
Right. And your website, inthepocket.org.
Yeah.
It could take you to ticket information.
Yeah.
What's the date on that again, Dave?
That's October 5th.
October 5th, In the Pocket at the Ardmore Music Hall.
Yeah.
Most of our listeners have seen In the Pocket, so they know. If you, for some reason, haven't seen In the Pocket, please go to the show, because, man, it's always it just keeps getting better. You've been doing it for 10 years, and it keeps getting better.
It's fun, man. The guys are so good and so cool. Everybody's so cool, and they get up, and we have fun. And you know, I can't say enough about it. Like, I did a little honor. We opened with Summertime Blues. This time on Sunday, because we didn't rehearse it. This is play Summertime Blues, and we did it. And we did it because
Joey DiTullio.
Joey killed it. Steve Butler, Greg Davis, Kenny Aronson, myself. And we went at it because a tribute to Woodstock, the spirit of Woodstock. Yeah. You know, we did some acid and we played. No, I'm kidding.
So anyway, go see In the Pocket at the Ardmore Music Hall in October, inthepocket.org for ticket information. Another great show. We're so fortunate to have someone who was actually performing at Woodstock here on the 50th anniversary of Woodstock.
Cool is that?
So thanks to Doug Clifford for being here. Thanks to Taylor, who's behind the glass. Thanks to Wildfire Radio for hosting us.
Yes.
Thanks to Philly Rock Radio, Kevin Law's birthday today. So
happy birthday, Kevin. Happy birthday, Kevin.
Thanks to our sponsors, Behavioral Pediatrics and ABA Therapy Associates, Proker Percussion, and Mark Maiolino.
Eagles and preseason tonight.
Yeah, Jacksonville, but no Nick Foles. No Nick Foles, no Carson Wentz.
I don't
think either of them are playing.
Okay.
But anyway, thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll see you next week on In the Pocket.
Right on.